Okay. So we're back on after having a lunch break, and we were talking before about, you mentioned conferences, attending conferences, and I'd like to hear about that generally in terms of, you know, what kinds of conferences you are attending and your experiences. And in particular, you had mentioned in some of your writings the Vanderwall's Centennial Celebration in Amsterdam. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that conference, what was involved in that, and your experience there.
Okay. I participated in professional meetings or conferences in a lot of different ways. You've asked about one specific one. It's customary for really, really important people like Vanderwall's to celebrate. This was the centennial of his death, I think it was, whatever it was. And so, it all started at Easter time when my daughters participated in sunrise service, and I had everybody in NYF come to my house and serve them breakfast afterwards. And I had pulled that table apart by myself. The next morning, I couldn't get out of bed. I had injured my lower back. And I had to literally roll over and let my body fall off onto my knees, and my husband lifted me up. I ended up in the hospital in traction. I had a ruptured herniated disc, and so I've had a bad back ever since. So I was in the hospital when we received the invitation to the Vanderwall's conference. That's the connection. And Ricky was, like me, he really appreciated the great names. And he was thrilled to death to be asked to participate. We were the only ones who gave two presentations from, you know, a single laboratory. And this was a special conference that they held in Amsterdam. And Ricky and I and Norman Carnahan, who I definitely want to have included in my, he was a colleague of mine that I did a lot with. And we went, and I did not present a paper, but I was co-author on both papers. And Ricky and Norman presented papers at that conference. And it was Amsterdam, which is different. And Ricky always gets into trouble. And we were walking in the red light district. The red light indicates women of ill repute who are happy to engage with their body to earn money. And one of the funny things, they have little kiosk over by the canals where the gentlemen can go and relieve themselves. Of course, the ladies can't. Ricky had to visit one of those. And those are one of the funny things I remember that. So that was a real honor to be asked to go and to be, and then, you know, somehow he got the money, or maybe I forgot whether I had to pay my own airfare or not, but anyway, we went to that. So that was an invited conference. It's the only one I ever got invited to. Ricky did invited to garden conferences, and John was invited to garden conferences at different times and things like that. Most of the meetings that I went to and participated in were from the professional societies, and were the ASCHE, and was the biggest one of those. And numerous ones of those, and I participated as an attendee, as a speaker, as a chair of a session, as a member of the membership committee, or the arrangements for this or that. And I never was a program chairman for one of those. It's extremely complex, extremely complex. And anybody in ASCHE who ever is a program chairman for one of the major meetings, those people need to be, thank you. I mean, it's really a tremendous service that they're doing to do that. So that was that type of meetings. I went to the meetings of the Gas Processors Association, and those are meetings of a marketing or business aspect where people get together. And they had technical meetings because they sponsored a lot of technical research, and we were one of the ones that we had to give reports on what we were doing. And I did a lot of other work with them too. Then there was another thing. This was another technical group to work with, called the Cryogenic Engineering Group. And this was headed by, his name, Hammerblau. I should remember the man's name. He's very prominent in cryogenic engineering. And he was at Colorado. I think that's right. And all of the annual meetings that they had for about 15 years had been in his home university, and he ran everything with that. This is a very small specialty group of small attendees, you know, less than 100, a small conference. Well, we, for some reason, Ricky decided to volunteer to have it at Rice with me to help him put it on. And Rice, as far as I know, had never had one of these before, and it was in the summertime, to use the empty dormitory facilities for the people to come. Most of the participants were university professors who didn't have a lot of travel money and travel expense. And you have to really be careful how you spend your money. So you're willing to stay in a dormitory, et cetera, to save money. Well, you've got to arrange everything else for the meeting. And I did it all with the help of all the graduate students that we had there in postdocs. When I say we did it all, that means you made the signs and went out and put them up with arrows pointing to tell people where to go in the campus. You made sure they had soap in their rooms to wash with. You made sure that they had the proper, to show your slides to give your talks, and that the rooms were prepared and at the right temperature. That the programs were printed to be passed out, that the name tags were made. Holding a technical meeting of any size, more than about three people, it gets complicated. Well, I was in charge of everything else. I didn't have to arrange the technical program. They did that part, but I had to be sure they had a room to sit in and that the room was ready for them. So I did that for that. So yeah, I attended lots of conferences, and I did a little bit of everything. In the same vein, John and I were very active in our church and have been, and it's been a very important part of our lives. And done a lot of Bible study, especially since we retired. And I've enjoyed that very much. But we were in a small church, no, not real small, a community church in the southwest part of Houston where we lived, called Westbury, for many, many years. And in the years that we were there, John and I, between us, held almost every position that you could hold in the church. We never were fixed Sunday school teachers, but I was a substitute Sunday school teacher. And if we would get to Sunday school and for some reason the teacher had not been able to prepare or was suddenly ill or something, and I would get up and I could get up and give the Sunday school lesson without any preparation. And one year I decided that we should have a Bible reading. And for a couple of years I would take the Bible, let it fall open, and then read that verse. Many, many times afterwards, somebody would come to me and say, that was what I needed to hear today. It happened over and over again. I did have a very deep religious experience at one time during those years. I was not particularly religious from the time that I went to Rice until this happened. But it's part about, you know, how do you feel about yourself question that you asked earlier. I didn't feel like I was worthy of being loved by God. And so therefore I didn't want to, quote, believe in God and to accept God. But I went through the motions of taking our children to church and everything. You know. But I had that experience, and I know what a religion, not everybody has an experience like this. And I appreciate that, but sometimes you do. It's like you ask my husband and I, yes, we fell in love at first sight. Well, I had a religious experience, and I knew that God loved me, and that Jesus Loves Me, to me, is the greatest hymn of all, because it's the most important thing, is that to the Christian, Jesus, to you as a Jew, Yahweh, but he loves you personally. And that is, it's just a tremendous feeling. But at any rate, while at the church, I organized the first ever garage sale they had, where we needed to make raise money for some particular thing, and we raised $3,000 or something. It was a big, big deal. I was treasurer of the church for years and counted the money and took it over and put it I was on the board of trustees. John was on the board of trustees. I was on the pastor parish committee. We were the what was called the church lay leader. And the year that, usually that's held by one person, but John and I, when they ask him to do it, he says, no, I can't do it unless Patsy helps me. And so we agreed to do it. And we personally attended at least one meeting of every subgroup in the church during that year. And this is a good-sized church, not an extra-large church, good-sized, and that's with a lot of stuff. So we made a real commitment to that. So it was that was a big part of our lives there. But the commonality, I was active in Scouts, I did the walking, I told you that. I did an awful lot of organizing and computer, another computer story. One year the preacher asked me to do something about the membership and stuff, and I wanted to put the church on the computer. This was in the days, this is how computers developed and in the history of computers. Of course, you know, he didn't want to do that. You can't keep those sacred records on the computer. Okay. So I learned to say no. Up to then, I hadn't said no. I said, okay, I'm not going to do it then. So there. Well, 3 years later, we were on computers. But the resistance to computers, anyone who's in a technical field at some point, I told you about my English teacher that blamed all of us freshmen for nuclear warfare and nuclear horrors. Anybody in the scientific area at some time in their life runs into this sort of a thing, and it's something we have to learn to deal with. It's very difficult to deal with, frankly.
And
does that add? I sort of expanded a little bit. I wanted to get all that in.
Yeah, that's great. And when you were talking about the computers, were you presenting about, when you were at conferences, were you and or your colleagues presenting work that was done on computers, and how did people respond to that?
Let's see. I stopped presenting, in the mid-70s. And the closest thing we did to presenting work done on computers was our correlation for corresponding states. And it is a complex set of calculations. You can do them without computers, but they are facilitated by using computers because they're very complex. As an aside, I think every chemical engineer should have to do one design by hand with using, well, I will let them use a calculator nowadays, using a slide rule nowadays, and design a tower with just that, so that they will appreciate all the work that goes into these correlations that we have, that all those ones that I helped develop for that book. Does that make any sense?
Okay. So
yes, we did present stuff that was result, but no, as the use of computers developed in the profession, we definitely incorporated them as rapidly as we could. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't. John participated in a prediction for Shell of where the computers are going to do. I've forgotten which year this was, and they were supposed to be predicting, for 20 years in advance. Well, they predicted this. This is what happened.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you describe with what you're doing with your hands?
Okay, now let me tell what I just described, a sort of a mild rise in information, and then I did an exponential curve. What they predicted would happen in 10 years happened in 3 years, and I don't know the precise numbers, but the idea is we never really recognized And he, I mean, John was a very smart man, and the other people on this committee were very smart committees, very smart people, technically wise, but it was very difficult to predict how fast that would develop. Mm-hmm. In our recent history with COVID, how fast the vaccine was discovered is absolutely, I was amazed. And the people working in the field, if you read some of the things that they say, they were amazed that it happened as quickly as it did.
Yeah, because I was sort of wondering if early on when you all sounded like were pretty much at the forefront of using computer technology, if there was skepticism in the field otherwise about it, or not so much?
No, I don't think we had any skepticism of the... We as an engineering community learned very quickly about garbage in and garbage out. And we knew you had to watch and you had to confirm and test. Hmm. And the further along that we got with all of the different things that happened, you had to worry about the security. And now one of my daughters, her husband, actually works for NASA. And what he does is verification of the accuracy of what has been done of any development, and it includes some of the computer programs and the double checking, and we learned that all of this has to be done. So that is the skepticism that exists in our society today. Mm-hmm. Now, but I don't think that I have a grandson who refuses to get vaccinated. They don't work, blah, 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 all sorts. It's complete nonsense. It's complete nonsense. And that does not exist in the technical community, in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think it exists. I don't think it ever did.
Well, were there any other notable conferences or presentations you gave that come to mind?
Okay. Going overseas to speak and having speakers from overseas come here. Back in the days when I've seen developments from the manual typewriter to the electrical typewriter to the computer now that we have, and the central word processing unit where they did this, all of this stuff. That's one thing. I've seen it in the reproduction of multiple copies, the development, everything you could possibly think of. And computers, and showing our slides, one of the things that we did at one time was use 35 millimeter slides. Do you know what they are?
I think so. You're sharing something.
Okay, the film, the 35 millimeter camera, took a picture, and it was 35 millimeters for the little film, and you mounted this in a little, or it was mounted, you didn't do it individually, in a cardboard holder. And these cardboard holders were placed in a round carousel, and you had a projector that would shine a light through them and put them up to show. Well, the thickness of the cardboard was different for Europe than it was for the United States. And they would start trying to show their European slides, and they would stick and not go forward, and you would have to change and have somebody go down there and put them through one at a time in order to show them. And then we would go to Europe, and our skinny slides would fall out of their carousels and not work. The same thing happened. This is a... Did you know that railroads, the right distance the rails are apart determine the rail cars that fit on them have to fit that? Did you know there are different ones?
No.
Yeah, and so if you had some that worked in England, they wouldn't work on the continent because they had two different measurements that they used, and they had to change the wheel part underneath in order to run the trains over there. So engineering as a profession sometimes does, it's like driving on the right side and the left side of the street for the cars. Sometimes you don't reach a mutual agreement worldwide, and it comes back to bite us. It's kind of funny, really thinking about it.
So I'm struck by that. One example is conversion to SI. So
SI,
in the
yes.
United States, at one point, we thought we'd go to the metric system, but you were...
Well, I was very, very active in that.
Okay.
Yes. At that time, I was on the editorial review... Oh, I served on the editorial review board for... as part of university academic activities, you review papers that are presented and give a written opinion, and the editor gives that to the person and they revise their paper to accommodate or do not revise or say go ahead and publish it. It's whatever it is. It's part of the review process to get it accepted to be published. And the reviewers have to be from the peer group who know what's going on. And so I was asked to review, and I reviewed many, many papers for many of the top chemical engineering journals. And I finally got asked to be on the editorial review board by Elsevier Publishing Company for a new journal called Fluid Phase Equilibria that they published once a year. And it was the big advances in that field of papers. And so I was on their review board for a number of years. I was also, as part of working for Hudson, on the editorial review board for the Natural Gas Processors Association Engineering Data Book, which, as I mentioned earlier, started out as just a small packet of graphs. Over the years, they developed a more comprehensive treatment approaching that of this formal bound volume that I developed with Ricky many, many years ago. And that was finished about the early 1970s, 73 or so. And in 75, when I changed my position and went back, when I ended up being hired by Hudson part-time, still worked part-time at Rice, and the first thing I did was do a major review of the engineering data book. That was in the English version. Later on, when I went to work for the company, I was appointed to be a full member of that review board, and then we were tasked with creating a metric version of the engineering data book. And I served in that capacity for, it took us about 6 or 7 years to do that. I've forgotten exactly why. I'll show you my plaques of recognition for that work. I think it's one of the biggest things that I did. That book is the reference book used all over the world. It's published in the hundreds of thousands of copies. So it's very important, and it's used by people who don't have English as their native language. And we have, this is how you do it in there. So it's very important that this is how you do it be written very correctly. And the people on the editorial review board were all, like myself, senior engineers with 20 or more years of experience in various aspects of the design and operation business. And we would sometimes discuss whether or not to put a comma in a sentence. I'm not lying. But creating the SI book, we first started, we were just going to take the English language book and put a conversion factor by the graphs and call that the SI version. And so we started off trying to do that, and we pretty soon discovered that we really couldn't do that, that it wouldn't work out. And one of the interesting things along that time, somebody goes off, he brings somebody new on. One of the guys they brought on was another Rice graduate. He was the president of Hudson Products. And we had our meeting in Tulsa. We had meetings like six times a year, perhaps. And these would be two-day meetings at some location. So, I mean, it was a major investment on the part of the companies that supplied the personnel to be the members of the board. Mm-hmm. And it was a major investment. Well, it's a very expensive book to produce. And really, really, it was hard work. Well, we had one particular thing, and we were going to translate it all, the whole thing, and really do everything and do it all in SI units and do the graphs in SI units, all that kind of stuff. And so we formed a system where the members of the review board were assigned particular chapters of the book to be responsible for. And I had my chapter assigned to me, and one of them involved thermal conductivity, which is a physical property that's very essential in designing heat exchangers and other equipment. And I also had the gas, the water content. Okay. And these both involve four or five different units, measurements. Okay, to measure temperature, it's either Fahrenheit or Celsius, or the absolute thing. To measure pressure, we've got several different units for that. Then there's the standard condition, and those are different for the two different systems. And then there's the mass. That's what ordinary people call the weight that you get on. So you weigh so many pounds, you also weigh so many kilograms. And if you're in the British system, you also weigh so many stone, you know. But at any rate, all of these have to be converted correctly. Well, I got the water content chapter back. I've got two stories. I got the water content, and there were two different water content charts in my section. And I'm going along and I look, and it suddenly dawned on me, that didn't look like the number I saw so many pages back. And I went back and looked. It was different. The same thing, and it had two different numbers. Okay, so we worked on that and we got that straightened out. See, what you had the subcommittee did it, they did all the review, then it went to the person in charge of it to review it, and then it went to the whole board, and the whole board reviewed it. I mean, we really, and it was a good thing we did. Well, so later on then, we're working along, and I got this new guy assigned, and we're meeting in Tulsa, and I had some particular thing, and the same thing had happened with thermal conductivity units as it happened on the water units. And I had sat down and worked with him and worked with him and worked with him, and I could get both results. So I worked with it more, and I finally decided the one I was pretty sure was right. And then, you know, when you've worked with it this long, well, I'm sure. So I went to the office, and we had about 20 process engineers. I went to everybody down the hallway, gave them the problem, you know, and I've forgotten what the amount, 18-1 or 8. Anyway, the vast majority got one thing. So, well, I'm pretty sure this is right. So then when I presented it to the board, I tell them this story and give them the numbers. So this new guy that's a new member of the group, this is just to show how intense we were about our work. We come back the next day after having a big dinner and everything, and he comes in bleary-eyed. Patsy, I was up till midnight working on that, and you're right. But we really took it very, very seriously doing that. And I think that that's the type of thing that generally engineers try to do. And that's why I always say safety, safety, safety. We want to, because, you know, I remember the last time I was talking to them, I pointed my finger at all these young kids. I said, you could kill somebody with what you do. And it's true. Okay.
Wow. So I'm wondering if there's anything else from your time working with Ricky Kobayashi in this period from...
And Tom Levin.
Yes. From this time, that's the 1960 period onward. If there are any major research projects or consulting projects that we haven't talked about that you wanted to mention?
Well, see, we talked about the hydric conditions. Okay, yes, the other colleague that I mentioned, I think you should talk about him a little bit, Norman Carnahan, did his doctorate at University of Oklahoma, and he was a theoretical chemical engineer. He did the hard sphere equation of state, and brilliant piece of work, absolutely brilliant. His wife has just been elected a fellow of AICHE the other day. Norman is still very active in AICHE, I know not, but he is. But Norman never was recognized in the United States for his work, unfortunately. But at any rate, he worked with Ricky on a lot of different things, and he was one of the people that Ricky would call up and talk to in the middle of the night a lot. He had a lot of stories about that. And but we got this, Ricky got this contract for the gas hydrates in the Alaska pipeline for the Prudhoe Bay and McKenzie productions, and we needed to know what would be the hydrate conditions for those particular compositions of gases that were expected from these fields. And using the Van der Waals Plateau solution theory equations and the theoretical information that we had, we did, Norman Carnahan and I did the calculations, and we prepared the charts I've shown you earlier today that were then used to operate those pipelines. I then used those specific points to do a generalized thing that was put onto the Gas Processors Association water content chart to warn of hydrate conditions. What that does is you treat the gas that has the water in it to take the gas, the amount of water has to reach a certain relative amount for any particular gas composition for the expected temperature and pressure range of where it will be operating for these hydrates to form. If it's not that composition, it doesn't have that much water in it, it won't form a hydrate. So the thing is, you take out as much water as you have to, but you don't want to take out, you cannot take out all of the water, in general speaking, and from a commercial standpoint. So you want to treat it just enough so that it's safe, but enough to be sure that it's safe. That's sort of a general design principle, no matter what you're making. So it's very important to know those.
Were there other things you worked with Carnahan on?
Yes, but I can't remember what they all were.
So you enjoyed working with him?
Oh, yes. We were both very active in some AICHE activities.
Okay.
And he still is. He's been active in the management division. You may know him. You may have met him at. Mm-hmm. You may have just haven't done him. Mm-hmm. His wife is from South America. Field is she catalysis? I should know. I just read her resume and said, I'm terrible at forgetting things, and names are one of my worst.
So I'd like to go back to, you talked about John getting this year abroad with Shell, and
yes.
You all had quite a bit of discussion and decided to do it.
Well, that was exciting, getting ready to do it. Our oldest daughter graduated from high school that year, and so she was going off to A&M to, you know, study. So she decided that we wanted to, you know, maximize what we could get. So she would go to summer school and then in the first semester, and then join us for the spring semester. That was the plan. Okay, so now you have to pack up me and John and our other three children and their musical instruments for a year abroad. Jack was just the age, 12 or 13, you know, and the year we were there, he grew like this, so that what fit one week didn't fit the next week. So that was a problem, but that was one of it. So we had to plan what to do. So we're also, this was February, I guess, when we found out about it, and we were to leave on around July 1st. June was to graduate from high school, the end of May, and to start living up, going to A&M and get her ready to go up there. So we had to get stuff ready for her to go there. And what we were going to take with us could go with us in three different fashions. It could go on the plane with us. It could go as a sea shipment with us, see? Or on the airplane, you could also ship stuff by air. So, and we were limited as to what we could put into each category. And then, of course, in your home, you have the precious things that you wouldn't dare put into ordinary storage. So those had to go to my mother's. And then you have the automobile, and it has to go to his parents to take care of up in Austin, and we got rid of the other automobiles and this. And then you have the piano. You don't put a piano into storage. Oh, no, that won't do. So it has to go to some friend's house. And then I had my freezer and stove and refrigerator and washing machine. Now, Carnahan, in the meantime, and his wife had just bought, I happened to buy a house and didn't have any of the appliances. So our appliances went there. The silver and precious holdings went to Mother's. The musical instruments that we left there, the piano, went to somebody else's house. The cat is the other thing. The cat has to have a place to stay, because you can't take, you know, taking a cat for a year is not practical. And then you have the sea shipment and the air shipment and what you take with you. And then you have what's going off to A&M with June. And we had piles all over the house and lists you cannot believe, but somehow or other we got it done, and we went for the year in Europe. And we got to Holland, and they met us at the airport and, you know, took us and put us up in a real nice hotel there. And I mean, the companies treat their expats really, really well. And they should, because it is a major, to live in a different country is a major shock. It always is. And it's interesting to do and all of that, but it is a shock and an emotional turmoil for everybody. Well, we lived in the hotel for a month, and during that month I had to go around and find us a place to live, and that was an eye-opener too. I didn't know that unfurnished meant that it didn't have any light fixtures. But that's what it meant in Holland. But at any rate, we finally found a place that was furnished. It actually belonged to somebody else, Michelle. It was from England. And it was in Rijswijk, and it was fairly close to the laboratory. And we had shipped over bicycles, and John rode a bicycle to and from our place where we lived to go to work. We did buy a car while we were there, so we had a car. And the children went to the American School of The Hague, so they had a place to do that. And to get there, they rode on the tram. They have a very good public system, transport system. Made me appreciate how horrible ours is. And generally speaking, in the United States, we do not have good transportation. I mean, the whole, well, Europe is so much more crowded than we are. I guess that they, anyway, their transportation system was much better than ours. My son, being the kind of kid that he was, after he got, when they got in school, they had a pass where they could ride the trams, you know, to show your pass. So he proceeded to ride every tram line in the city all the way out to the end of the line and back. I found out all about it. And you had to learn about the streets, the names, like so many places, wherever you live. And you have a street that starts off with one name and it goes for a while and changes to another name, goes well and goes, changed to another name. And one time I was out driving in the Hague, and I got turned around in my mind. And I thought east was west. And it took me the hardest time to get straightened out, and I finally did. But it was fun. It was a challenge, and we enjoyed it, and we're glad we went. But I took a leave from the university, but Ricky agreed that I should, you know, keep working and doing a little bit. Maybe I got a small stipend from them during that year. And I would get papers to review and budgets and drafts of proposals and send my comments in and do things like that. And then I took one particular person's work who had finished and had to return to their homeland, and I wrote the paper for that during that year. And then I joined the American Women's Club of The Hague, and they had a monthly trip and then a couple of longer trips, weekend trips, and I went on every one of the monthly trips and the long weekend trips. And then the family, every time we had a chance, would take a vacation and go places. And then I went on professional trips. The first thing I did was, shortly after we arrived, I went to an international meeting. AICHE periodically has international meetings. I previously attended one in Mexico City, in AICHE. This one was in Germany, in Munich, and I went there, and I'll refer back to that meeting later. So I went there and attended that meeting. It's very, and their Museum of Science and History is absolutely fabulous. If you ever go there, you must see it. And also, in Munich, I visited their a library, and it was a very old library, and it was a floor as big as this house, had twice as big. It was gigantic, and it was all Bible research, all of these theses and things that, of course, are written in every language that you can imagine. It was astonishing to see. So I tried to maximize everything I did, and then I did that meeting. I made two or three trips to England to speak, and then I went to towards the end of the year, I went to a speaking tour a week in Czechoslovakia and a week in Poland. And I finally ended up at the end of the year, I personally had been traveling or something 6 months of the year. Well, I wanted to do as much as I possibly could. And then I also professionally during that year had some consulting work in Holland and in England. I had a short consulting job with BP and a short consulting job with Shell, and then a little bit longer one with a pipeline company in The Hague. And it was so funny that it was like making a batch of cookies or something, very, very simple to do, just involved a couple of paper liquid calculations to find out what they needed. And so they would give me something to do, and I would bring it back that afternoon, and they'd say, oh, I thought we'd be here. Oh, we'll call you when we get the next one ready. And then 3 or 4 days later, they would be ready for the next one. And I'd do it immediately and went on. But I also spoke in, I spoke about the research state of in thermodynamics as far as the general state of what it, at several places in England. I spoke at Leeds University, Imperial College. I participated in a conference at Oxford, and I spoke at University of London, and I conferred with the whatever our British counterpart of AICHE is, something they were doing. I conferred with them at that time, and then I went to the Czechoslovakia. I spoke at the Institute of Macromolecular Chemistry and at the laboratory where the man who had come and done postdoc. We had postdoc fellows from both places. That's why I went to those places. And the man who came from Czechoslovakia was named Ivan Wichterly. His father had been the one who developed a contact lens on their kitchen stove, used colloidal chemistry. And he did it using a boiling pan of water on his kitchen stove. As a result, he was world famous, and they got all of this money from all of the patents for soft contact lens and formed the Institute of Macromolecular Chemistry. Then they had the uprising in Czechoslovakia against the Russians, and Dr. Wichterly, who had been head of the laboratory, was relegated to a sub-basement next to the furnace type office. And his children had three brilliant sons. And to achieve those days, if your country was behind the Iron Curtain, which it was, you had to do your postdoc in Moscow. Well, of course, they weren't considered eligible. But somehow or other, they could leave one at a time and be gone for only 1 year. And he had to return. You know, he couldn't get it extended one day, nothing. And I remember the letter we got from him after he returned. I am at home in my unhappy country. Mm-hmm. And it's the only sentence I remember of that letter. But there was a good story there, too. When I got off the plane, traveling alone to begin those 2 days speaking, there was this young kid who looked about half your age, holding an Uzi under his arm, greeting people as they got off the airplane. I've never felt so vulnerable in all of my life. That was the beginning of it. Before that, when you went on, before that, you can't believe this, Sarah, you're too young, but I know that you can probably remember. You went out to get on a plane and you just walked up and you got on the plane. You didn't have to be searched and wanted and have your baggage checked out and everything. No, no. But there was the Uzi. And it was a shock. Well, when I finished, this is before cell phones. Okay, my youngest daughter was to meet me in Poland. She wanted to come and see, and she really wanted to go to Auschwitz, is what she wanted to do. But she wanted to come and be and find out. So, yeah, okay, you can do that. And so she left. I left Czechoslovakia to go to Poland. Well, I had a reservation on the airplane to go, and she was flying from Holland at the same time through Berlin, changed planes, and then to Warsaw in Poland to meet me. Well, when we got out there from my plane, this was May the 1st, and on May the 1st, they changed all of the flights and the timing of the flights, and the plane took off an hour before I got there. How we managed to not get, well, yes, this was the day before computers were common, remember? So you couldn't check your flight. Anyway, so the plane took off, so my host took me down and got me on a train, and I went by train from Czechoslovakia to Poland. And during the night, you went across the borders and all, they have to come and check your papers and all this kind of stuff, and up come these burly people with their stamps. The stamp pad was taped to her wrist, or so it was whoomp, whoomp, to stamp it on there and then stamp it on your paper. And then she got my stack of slides and started holding up these 35 millimeter slides that had the drawings on them and looking at them. Well, I was terrified, of course, not knowing what to do, because you see, I had a slide in there. There was a young lady in a rather bikini outfit, you know, to use in case it was appropriate to have a little bit of a joke in the presentation. I never did use it, but I was prepared if it worked out that I really needed to. I was terrified that they would find it and then accuse me of pornography or whatnot. And I finally found my letter of invitation to Poland and showed it, and oh, okay, okay, and she stopped looking at that. Well, I finally get to Poland. It's May Day. Everybody's on holiday. The laboratory is closed. Of course, my host doesn't know where I am. My daughter, in the meantime, had gone. They had waited at the airport for her until her plane got in and taken her to their home. So I went out with my letter, and found a taxi and showed it to him, and I want to go to this place. And so he took me there. Remember, I don't speak a word of Polish. And is that the right language? Yeah, I think it is. So they take me out to the laboratory. Well, everybody's on holiday for May Day, but there is a guard on this laboratory installation, and he sees the signature of Dr. Strzyzek, and he calls him, and he comes and gets me, and then we get down and get him put into our hotel room, and everything works out okay. But boy, that was a shocker. But I got to speak in Warsaw. I spoke at the Marie Curie Institute. Let me touch my hand. I mean, that's exactly what it felt like. And then I got to the University of Krakow, and they treated me like visiting royalty. I was really amazed. It was graduation time, and they had a special ceremony, and you know, I'm sitting in the back of the room with Juliet, and I was introduced as the distinguished visitor from the United States, and all of the professors come in, and you've all seen the academic regalia. But have you ever seen them where they have a big gold medal about the size of a dinner plate hanging around their necks? Mm-hmm. That's what they had on. Well, after that, they took us in back to the hotel the next morning, picked me up, and I was going over to give my talk. And they tell me I'm going to be talking with an interpreter. And that was the only indication I had that I had an interpreter, you know, as we were driving from the hotel to the place where I gave my talk. Well, I start the talk and we're going along just fine, and he didn't interpret something correctly. How I knew it, I do not know, because I don't know what the man said, but I knew it was wrong. And so I turned to him in English and told him, I said so-and-so, and it meant this and this and this. Oh, and he nods at him, oh yes, and I could see the light come in his eyes. And then he says, talks, and everybody's lights, oh, You could see their faces come. Oh, now we know what she's talking about. And you know. And we finished that talk. And so then the next day they were going to take us and show us the beautiful sights and all. We got to go to a salt mine in Poland that dated from Roman times. Very old. And they had a very interesting thing. They had a hospital in the bottom of the mine. You can treat tuberculosis and other lung diseases with high pressure, greater than sea level pressure. And so they put the people down there and treated them in this sub-basement. And then there were beautiful carvings that the miners had made down in this out of salt, like the Pieta type thing. Mm-hmm. Very impressive. And after that, my daughter has extremely good friends who are Jewish, and so we asked to go to see Auschwitz, and we went to Auschwitz instead of seeing their mountains. And it was one of the most impressive things that happened in my life was going there. That was our year abroad, and we came back, and I realized from my interactions with the people in Europe that I was recognized, and I discovered I was not recognized on the campus and would never be recognized because I did not have a doctor. So that's when I decided to change and go into industry. And NSF wanted me to come and work for them, but that would have meant working in Washington. And I didn't want to work in Washington and have my husband working in Houston. And my family and all, it just, that wasn't possible. And I talked to some other engineering companies, and they offered me opportunities to do what I'd essentially been doing already, be an information specialist. And so I ended up deciding to go with the Hudson Engineering Corporation.
And before we get to that, there might be a few more things about your time in Europe. I don't know if, Gail, you had anything
questions
to ask.
So I understand the lectures, but for the sort of consulting work, did people find you or were you actively looking?
Oh, no, I didn't actively look. They found me.
Okay. And you described very well so many aspects of that year and what you were doing. Like a year later, what was your kind of takeaway, your reflections on that time in Europe?
Well, I really did enjoy seeing so many of the things that I've always liked fine art, and I got to see the Mona Lisa. I now know why the Mona Lisa is the best painting in the world. I don't like it, but it is the best. In fact, my first time I went to Europe with my husband, and I went to Prince Maurits' house, and I hadn't had much time to go to museums and things, but I was, you know, vacation. And I went in and they had a directory in English, and Maurits' house was full of the 17th and 18th century Dutch masters. You know, people like Rembrandt. And they described one painting in each room in their little English book, so I'm sure it was the best painting in the room. And I say what you do when you go in a room and here's full of art, a new museum, look around, pick out the painting that you like the best, and pick out the painting that is the best in the room. And so I did that, for that. In every case, the one I selected for the best was the one that was described in the book. And it really, I got to see a tremendous amount of art, and the whole family liked that. You know, we went to Italy at Christmas time, and it would happen to be the Jubilee year, and we heard the Pope give the Jubilee address. He does this every 20 years or 25 years from the balcony of St. Peter's. And, it was to see and do the things of that year. But, you know, this is where so much of our country comes from, is from Europe. And in my particular background, it's very much tied there. So, I mean, I enjoyed seeing how the people live and seeing, it was just different. It was great. I really think if you get an opportunity to live abroad, you should. There's some people that, I don't think it's good. There were some families whose, as Americans, spent their entire life abroad with their children in the, you know, American schools there. And I think that is very bad, because those children do not ever get an exposure to the American culture if you spend your entire life abroad. And a disadvantage as an American abroad, I mean, we had more income per capita than what Mr. Man on the Street had. So you had to be careful. You had to be careful that your children did not get an impression that they were better than other people.
And I was wondering about that with your children. Do you have a sense of what that experience was like for them, being in a school in Europe and having chances to travel if they traveled with you? It sounds like you did some family traveling.
We traveled at every opportunity that we had.
Mm-hmm.
The girls had a friend, for instance, who came over shortly after we were there, mm-hmm. and visited with them, and that's when we did one of our trips to England as a family, so that the girl could get that experience. They made friends of the people that, their classes had people from all over the world. My son made a very good friend whose father was a Japanese, and he was Japanese,
mm-hmm.
and he was friends with him all of his life. My daughter made friends with a Dutch girl who had her parents sent her to that school for some particular enrichment program, and mm-hmm. at the end of our time there, we came back and spent vacation time at the end of the year a little bit in England, and Julie instead went with her Dutch friend, and the two girls went by themselves to Switzerland and stayed at hostels and stuff going down there, and then the Dutch family met them there and came back to Holland, and then Julia got on the airplane and flew to London and took the train and everything and came and met us in our hotel in London. She was 16 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they learned very early to deal with things. The school had special trips. Our son went on the school trips. One of them was to in northern France. And one was to the Alps. He learned to ski in the Austrian Alps. One of them had a trip to Russia.
Hmm.
And her older sister had come by that time, and she went with her, and they went with the teacher from the school on a trip to Moscow. So they got to go to Moscow. You know, they got to see and do a lot of things, too.
We talked about World War II yesterday, and there was this thing that's now called the Cold War. And you mentioned going to Poland and the Czech Republic, I guess it's called now, Czechoslovakia then. Did you have any impressions then of the Eastern Bloc and seeing it, I guess, up close and personal?
Yeah. The grocery store.
Mm.
If you want to know about a country, go in the grocery store. Visualize your local supermarket and you want to buy a box of washing soap. What do you see when you walk down the aisle? You see an aisle that is full of 15 different brands of washing soap and all the additions and all the other additives and the things to go in your dryer and all of this stuff. I would go in the grocery stores there, and I would go in that aisle, and there would be three boxes of one kind of washing soap in the whole aisle. When we got to Poland, and we were in the hotel, we looked out one morning, and there was this little store down beside, and all of a sudden, there was a huge line people outside the store. And I asked, you know, what had happened and all, and found out they had just gotten a shipment of something. So all of these people were in line to buy a box of something. Whatever it was, it didn't matter. If they saw the line and they had the time, they got in it. because if they couldn't use it, their neighbor could. When we adopted the, well, my children did the adoption, of course, but I went to help adopt my grandchildren. And that was in Romania. And they were just recovering from having killed the guy and all that kind of stuff. And we needed diapers when we went back for the little boys. And my son-in-law was with me. And he went out shopping for diapers. And he shopped all morning, and he came back with a package of diapers that was the size of a small box of Kotex. I don't know whether you've looked at diapers in our, if you pick up diapers in our stores, the package is like 2 feet by 3 feet by 2 feet. You don't buy them in little teacup sized containers. So that impression of the difference between behind the Iron Curtain and not. That's the and yet another trip made in later life to Russia with my daughter and her son, just got his degree from Rice. This is in recent years. And dragness, darkness, black clothing, unhappy looks on people's faces and no smiles. And if you spoke to somebody, they were afraid to speak back to you. Those are my impressions of behind.
So after this wonderful year in Europe with all this new sort of exposure, stimulation, interaction, even professional recognition, was it hard to adapt to life back in Texas?
Well, you didn't have the opportunity to be planning another trip for where you're going to go next and this sort of thing. That was the thing. Of course, when we got back, it was the middle of the summertime, and getting the kids back and all of the preparations for them to go back to school and everything. And, you're busy changing and unpacking and putting things back in order and getting your things out of storage and retrieving what's stored where. You're too busy to reflect very much. Is that still working?
Yes, it is. I was just making sure.
Okay. And you said you realized you were recognized in Europe.
Yes.
But then at Rice, you heard you'd never be recognized without a PhD. Is this a sense you got, or did someone just tell you that? Or
when I was at the University of London University, and I was speaking with Professor McGlashan, and he asked me, why didn't I have a doctorate? And he was shocked to learn that Rice had never awarded an honorary doctorate. And then when I returned and started back working with Kobayashi and Maiden, I did something that I probably should not have, looking back, I should have talked to Riku, telling what I was going to doing. But I didn't. I thought I understood him better than that, and he understood what I did better than that. And I tried to, I had a lot of graduates, new people that had come during the year to meet, and then we had a new crop coming in, and I had a lot of people to meet, and so I asked them all to come to meet with me so that they could meet me and I could meet them and I could tell them all the general information that everybody needed to do. And he canceled my meeting. And that showed to me that he didn't have confidence in my ability, I felt, or whatever it was. And at that time, so the first thing I did was to start working part-time for Hudson Engineering, because I was theoretically part-time at Rice, although I had never strictly enforced that. So I decided, okay, I'm going to, I gradually changed my mind. It wasn't an instantaneous decision at all. And so I decided to, okay, I'm gonna see what I can do. And Warren asked me to come out to work with him on the, since he had been on the GPSA engineering data book where they had written the big version of it, and he had me go through it, and I went through it and found all had an errata pocket and everything, very big, and rewrote a major section of it. Did a major revision, in other words. And so during that time, I also was a resource for all the people who had data problems when they were, whatever design project they had, and I could tell them what data to use or where to find the data they needed. And so I was a resource person for them. Another was acting sort of like a consultant, in-house consultant. And so then I decided, okay, it's just an atmosphere. I didn't feel good in the atmosphere anymore. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to go and work in, quote, real industry, do real engineering. And so I started looking around for engineering companies, because I didn't want to go with another oil company. And that was, so
why was that? Was it just you weren't interested in that field, or you?
My husband worked for Shell.
Oh, I see.
So I didn't want a person.
Okay.
I didn't want a conflict in my bed.
I see.
So, at any rate, I didn't want the NSF job because I would be in. And I actively pursued, where should I go to work? And Warren White, the head of, he was the vice president of Hudson Engineering, and he offered me a job to come and work there as a process engineer, and so I decided to take that job.
That seems like a pretty good, what we call these days, a pivot, because you had done more research, right? And you had done some design, but that's
minor amount of design.
Okay, so now it's like full-time, maybe going back to your first job at Shell, but full-time design, full-time
Shell
project.
Allegedly research, but it really wasn't. Shell was really operations, actually trying to learn how to operate and run a plant.
I mean, this is, you could say, mid-career.
This is a mid-career.
Engineering,
there's operating and running a plant. There's doing the research. There's doing the management. And there's doing the education. There's all of these aspects of engineering. And I've gotten to participate in just about every one of them, which is unusual.
What gave you the confidence? Some people wouldn't have that confidence to go, wow, this part of my career was doing this, and now I'm just going to take this leap to project.
Why am I should be any harder? I mean, I knew what to do. I mean, I know it. When I did project management, did project engineering, I went and took a course in project management. I knew everything the guy was trying to teach me before I ever took the course. So I really didn't need the training in project management. I used computers. I didn't need any training in how to do programming.
And you'd already been working with Hudson part-time. So.
Well, I've been working with Hudson part-time, so I knew something about the atmosphere there.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you be afraid?
Some women today would not make that jump.
Or even probably, men, people of other genders too.
Yeah, they would just want to stay in maybe what you call a comfort zone. Or
mm-hmm.
You have a thirst for new things that we're picking up.
Well, I just never even thought about being afraid to try and go in some different direction. Being afraid, yes, and cautious of certain things, like the guy with the Uzi and all. That kind of shook me. But as far as me personally being afraid to tackle anything, no.
Some would also say that's a big change from sort of, in essence, a job in industry versus a job more academic.
Oh, there's
oriented.
A huge difference.
And can you say a couple of what you saw as the differences?
The dollar sign.
Being higher in industry, or?
The dollar sign, no, the dollar sign is very important in any place. But the to me, the dollar sign represents so much an attitude about what you're interested in. And yet, as an engineer, no matter what part of engineering you're doing, you better be aware of that dollar sign. Because you have to have the dollar sign to accomplish anything. And in order to have anything be recognized, you've got to have the dollar sign. It all comes back to the dollar. I mean, it's a very...
Got to know the business value of what you're...
Not the business value. Like the work I told you about the man that did the discovery. When you finally left him alone for just a few weeks, he could really do something. I mean, it's different working for a... And depending on the size of the company and the company philosophy and... And then companies, institutions, I'll use the word instead of companies, institution covers education as well. They change. They do change. And that's what you were asking about at Rice today. What do we know about where we went to school today? We really don't. We're not there.
And so, you know, how would you describe the environment working at Hudson? What was the work environment like there?
Very high integrity, pride in what we did. The company had some really good practices, I think, as far as process design goes. You were assigned a particular plant to design and get going. As a process engineer, you had to do the process diagram and design the plant and then work with the instrument people to pick out the instruments to be used and work with the piping people to make sure that they did it right and all. But you started out with your process flow diagram, which is the master guideline, and you developed it to a certain point, and then your mechanical flow diagrams had even more. But we had two stages. Your process flow diagram goes up. Everybody in the process design department, everyone, including the vice president, who's a process farmer from that background, spent at least an hour reviewing that diagram to see if they had any comments to put on it. And then when you did your mechanical flow diagrams, they did the same thing. The mechanical flow diagrams have a lot more information than the process flow diagram. Mm. And they personally come in and spend times, and you put your big drawings up in a display room and have it up there for a week for everybody to come in and put their comments on. And then you have to gather all those comments and work on them and try to make sure that you resolve all the issues that have been raised. And not all companies do that. And I think that's, and because it was a small company, they could do that. But it was, the company started with a man named Hudson, unusual. And when he started, when my friends that had been there for many years had started, they worked on Saturday morning also. But he would talk, in the early days of the gas processing industry, you get a production and you own this field and all and you want to have it developed, and he would make a deal with the people to do it, and they would put the details on the back of a piece of an envelope and they would shake hands, and that was the contract, and they would go out and build a King Ranch facility type of thing from it. I think King Ranch is actually built in that way. That's one of the biggest gas processing facilities in the world in South Texas.